man. God, that voice. I just love this so much. I was coming in this morning, and I thought to myself, not only will this be a great day, because it's our last show before the holidays, and so there's that, but also I said, I know we're going to get to hear Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and it's just, oh, lovely. I love the people that we're going to talk to, but if we just played that album twice in a row, we could do that too. But no, we have work to do. It's a great album called It's a Holiday Soul Party. And if you get a chance, it's just fantastic. And you'll be hearing it throughout the morning, so you'll get to realize that yourself if you don't already know. Good morning, all. It is the 23rd of December, and as I mentioned, we're going to be out on Christmas Eve. We will be we'll be out on Christmas Day and back on the 26th, and we have all kinds of holiday specials planned and ready to go. So there's that, and we hope, of course, that you have a beautiful, beautiful holiday, both this week and next week, and we'll be doing a lot of great stuff over the next 2 weeks, and doing some best of stuff, and doing some new stuff, and some year end stuff. So a lot going on, but we do want to, and of course we'll be having the panel with our wonderful panelists. But I just want to wish everyone a beautiful holiday season, and hopefully you'll have a really good one. And then we'll talk later about our wishes for the new year. Our wishes of how great 2026 can and will be, we hope. We'll give it a shot. Let me introduce our panel today. I'm very happy to have these individuals in one room. Editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer of the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, is with us. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well, and I didn't realize this was the last show before the holiday, so I won't have a crossword for anyone or anything today.
Oh, no, we don't want
for
that.
For the next minute.
No.
While you're doing the rest of the introduction.
You can be bitter as you want to be, Jay. I don't want to stop anything. It's my gift to you.
Thank you.
Yes. Also, former Times Associate Editor Mike Spain is with it. Hello, dear friend. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here on the edge of the holidays and looking forward to all that. Yeah.
Indeed. And I am so glad you're all here. Also, the mayor of the city of Albany, it's the last time I can say this on this program without the word former before it. It is the last appearance of Kathy Sheehan on our program as mayor. The term is over, what, the 31st?
That is correct.
Yeah, midnight. When that ball drops, you're done. You're done.
And they can't see the big smile on my face.
No.
That I have.
Well,
the audience at home, but let it be noted.
I congratulate you. I congratulate you on 12 years and just an amazing run. And we thank you so much for being so wonderful to us and to coming on the show and talking about various issues over your entire term, and we wish you all the best. But I will say to listeners, and we'll be talking a little bit about Kathy's leaving later on in the show, but I will say that we are thrilled that Kathy will remain a regular panelist on the program, and after you get rested up and the dust settles, you'll be back and coming in here and sharing your thoughts on things.
I'm looking forward to it.
I look at the model of this as Judy Patrick. Judy Patrick, for years and years, was the editor of the Daily Gazette, and Judy would come in here and she would talk, and she would be just the perfect journalist. It was just great, and then she retired.
The gloves were off,
and the gloves were off.
That's funny.
And I look forward to that with you as well.
Yeah. Well, I've never.
You never really had a lot of
I've really never been known for my filter.
No.
But yeah.
But now you really, you know, who gives? You know, it's good. So we look forward to that. Let me get to reminding you that you can be a part of the program as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. www.hallidaysfestival.org, and we will get started this morning. I am going to start in a weird place just because, not really weird, but I'm going to start in a place because we didn't talk about the story yesterday. I wanted to talk about the story yesterday, but I wanted to wait till we had journalists in the room. So today we have journalists in the room, and I really want to talk about the 60 Minutes story. It's quite something, and I think, you know, it's to me, it's the whole time that the merger was going through, and there was the payoff, and Colbert got booted. You thought to yourself, well, this doesn't seem like it's going to go well, right? And then we saw some new people coming into place within CBS and with 60 Minutes. So in a move that drew harsh criticism from its own correspondent, CBS abruptly removed a segment from Sunday's episode of 60 Minutes that was to feature the stories of Venezuelan men deported by the Trump administration to what the program called a, quote, brutal prison in El Salvador. CBS announced the change just 3 hours before the broadcast, a highly unusual last-minute switch. The decision was made after Barry Weiss, the new editor-in-chief of CBS News, requested numerous changes to the segment. CBS News said in a statement that the segment would air at a later date and needed, quote, additional reporting. Sharon Alfonsi, who is a veteran 60 Minutes correspondent who reported this segment, rejected that criticism in a private note to CBS colleagues on Sunday, in which she accused CBS News of pulling the segment for political reasons. And then there's this line from Sharon Alfonsi, who I just think this is really tells the story. Our story was screened 5 times. Cleared by both CBS attorneys and standards and practices, Ms. Alfonsi wrote in the note, a copy of which was obtained by the New York Times. It is factually correct. In my view, pulling it now, after every rigorous internal check has been met, this is not an editorial decision. It is a political one. Ms. Weiss said in a statement late Sunday, my job is to make sure that all stories we publish are the best they can be, holding stories that aren't ready for whatever reason, that they lack sufficient context, say, or that they are missing critical voices, happens every day in every newsroom. I look forward to airing this important piece when it's ready. Sunday's unusual events have once again placed 60 Minutes at the center of a media and political fracas. And I should say, of course, 60 Minutes being one up until maybe the past year, a gold standard in television journalism and has been for over 50 years, almost 60 years, and continues. I think many journalists there still operate under those principles that have been part of this for a very long time. And we now see sort of what they're up against. Jay.
You know, as you were reading her memo, I just wanted to cut in and go, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the telling line in that story for me was when she handed Miller's contact information to the journalist, or I think it was to the journalist who was talking out about the story. I had that happen to me once in my career where an editor said to me that they wanted some more reporting on it. And have you spoken to so-and-so? I have their number right here. And it was clear that they had, you know, cut in on that. But the fact that the administration had not commented on the story, they had stonewalled them on the story. And then the Barry boss is saying, I want you to call. The administration wants to talk to you about this.
Right. Then the Barry Weiss turns and says,
I think it was Miller.
Stephen Miller. Yeah. You need Stephen Miller on this, or the White House Deputy Chief of Staff. And the architect of Trump's immigrant crackdown, so immigration crackdown.
So with a good editor, saying you need additional reporting on it is a very credible thing to say. In this case, it's not a credible thing to say. 60 Minutes did their work on this, as the as the reporter noted, that this was you know, it was worked on, it was cleared, it was screened five times. I didn't know they did that kind of thing, but all this was just a veto by the administration over a story they didn't want to get in, and I think it really hurts their credibility. I think Barry Weiss's days at CBS are numbered after this.
But they got what they wanted, right? I mean, that's
the administration
that's
a, got
yes,
what they wanted.
I mean, that's
sure.
the person they wanted in there.
And I think, you know, presumably Paramount Skydance is going to get what they want in the way of
that's
getting
right.
Netflix.
Yes.
But I don't think journalistically I think this could be the straw that broke the camel's back at CBS.
Ms. Weiss also questioned the use of the term migrants to describe the Venezuelan men who were deported, noting that they were in the United States illegally. Mike Spain.
I'll be a little contrarian to my longtime colleague, Jay. An editor has to make a tough decision, and she was, whether you like it or not, and I'm not happy I was very concerned when Barry Weiss was named head of all of CBS News. But she's the editor, and she does have to have a responsibility for making calls. Now, the way that, and you, there are different versions of this story out there. Mm-hmm. Did the administration refuse to comment, or did they only issue statements? And what Barry Weiss wanted was to have a guy on camera or a woman on camera with their voice on the story to give it quote-unquote balance. There's this debate going on, and we just don't know all the details of it. But certainly Axios reported that, you know, there were comments, and they didn't include them because they weren't new, and they didn't respond specifically to some of their questions. But you could say the administration has consistently said dot, 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 and that might have covered it. Who knows? She also said that this will air. And in a way, that'll get more eyeballs than it would have on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the way it backfires on the administration. The New York Times. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, especially if Cheryl Fonzi is the one introducing the piece and says, by the way.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it'll be very interesting to watch it play out. I don't think this is over. If it ends up carrying a perfunctory denial or refuting by some administration spokesperson and airs, and it's as powerful as it is. I mean, it's out there. Yeah. You can see it. And these Venezuelans who were just, you know, out of a couple of hundred Venezuelans, eight of them were had serious criminal records, and the rest did nothing or very little. And yes, the New York Times reported that 2 months ago. But 60 Minutes, Washington Post, ABC News, you name it, they all do stories that other media do, and they amplify it, and they bring, in the case of television, they bring you the visual and the audio of somebody actually saying something, which can be a lot more compelling than just reading it. Mm-hmm. And it will have impact if it is published. I mean, I'd like to see how this plays out. She's brand new. I like I said, I don't think she had the resume that made her qualified for the job that CBS put her in to. But in the end, let's see what she does at this point. I mean, an editor has to make tough decisions. I've delayed stories so that people had comments on them.
So in her note, Ms. Alfonsi said that her team had requested comment from the White House, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security. As you rightly point out, there were many there are a couple narratives out there about what happened here. But she said, Ms. Alfonsi said, if the administration's refusal to participate becomes a valid reason to spike a story, we have effectively handed them a kill switch for any reporting they find inconvenient. Reach on Sunday evening, Ms. Alfonsi said, I refer all questions to Barry Weiss.
Well, if only it had been that easy for me as mayor to kill the many stories that your publication wrote.
Yep. Right. Now they tell
me. Now they tell me. If only I had known. But I just want to say that, first of all, the story is out because apparently it's streamed in Canada.
Right.
And so the story as it was meant to be seen on Sunday
Canada.
It is accessible. Thank you, Canada. But I also think that, you know, as we look at why, right? Mm-hmm. Why would the administration want to kill this story? I think that Americans need to understand the consequences of the complete and utter failure of this administration to provide even the bare minimum of due process to people. And America, our country, sent these people to this brutal, horrible place. And we can say, and the administration seems to take the position of, well, that's not us. They were here illegally, and we deported them. And what happened to them when they got there? Well, that's not on us. And I don't know how any person can listen to these stories and watch what has happened to people who have been denied due process and not take pause. Because if it can happen to them, it can happen to anyone. And I think that is the real story here and the conversation that we need to get to, and that these are ways of getting to that underlying story. These are human beings. You know, I think when we look at what people may have been deported for, and people have to realize that if a person who is here legally gets pulled over for drunk driving, shoplifts, you know, these are pretty minor offenses as we would look at them, right? You know, if your kid gets arrested for shoplifting, I don't think that you think, oh, yeah, it's okay for you to send them to a supermax prison in another country where they're going to get beaten and tortured. And so this is where I think the conversation needs to get to. And again, I think that's what the administration is trying to tamp down. And this is because of their failure to actually come up with real implementable immigration policy and pass it through Congress.
But the other problem, too, is that the administration was upset over the Marjorie Taylor Greene story on 60 Minutes. They spoke out about that and said, and Trump said that he didn't want, he didn't like that story. And he there's this, I don't think this is any secret, and I don't think I'm being offering commentary here. I think it's true that the president of, whether it be his Justice Department or the FBI or the Department of War, he feels that it is his because those are in control. And it feels as though with the deals that were made with CBS and with the deals that the payoff. And the
do you mean the $15 million settlement that CBS made to Trump?
Indeed, that is exactly what I mean. And then the subsequent firing of Stephen Colbert, and then the Barry Weiss being put in this position to keep it under control. I don't. It just seems that I think you have an argument to be made that. That Trump sees this as his, that he's done something for them and they should be doing things for him. And one of those things is to kill stories that make the administration look bad.
I think that's true. And I think that I get everything you're saying, Mike. I think thinking back when I was a reporter or a junior editor, or a less senior editor.
By the way, just both as journalists, you'd be ticked. You'd be in the Alfonsi camp if you were the reporter on this.
I'd be furious.
Absolutely.
And I'd be furious for this reason, for exactly the reason the mayor touched on, very humorously, thank you, is that you don't want people in power thinking that they have a kill switch. That's, even if that's not what happened, even if Barry Weiss had a legitimate reason or two to say, let's tweak it just a little bit more, let's get a live interview with Miller, let's get somebody on camera, maybe we can get the president, maybe we can, you know, get somebody, maybe we could even get the president of El Salvador in this. But even if you have all those reasons, to give them even the feeling that they have control over the story is a dangerous, dangerous thing. And I knew that as a reporter long ago and pushed back very hard when I felt that editors were doing that.
Timing is everything. And if you miss the window where you have the public's attention, the story won't have the impact, mm-hmm. and the work will not have gotten seen by the right number of people in time for something, for example. Like if there's an election coming up and you're writing a story about a politician who might have engaged in domestic violence right on the eve of election day. And if you hold that story another week so you can check it all out, you deny the public the access or the ability to know that information. However, if you are wrong about the story or you it just isn't accurate, you've done another disservice. I mean, it's a tough situation for an
it's
editor on a
Comey
deadline.
Problem.
Yeah, a Comey problem. There's a lot of problems that could be made.
But what we have is a president who is systematically looking to silence any criticism.
Right.
And that's because we have someone who became president and is motivated by wanting to be adored and unquestioned. And as I look at public service, and I can joke about the coverage that I received over the last 12 years, because I didn't do this job to become adored. This isn't about creating a cult of personality. This is about making difficult decisions, policy decisions, that while people may disagree with them, you should be able to explain them. They should be able to understand them. And when I look at what we have now, this is not normal, and we keep saying that. But if you look at Project 2025 and what the goal was, this is all part of that playbook. I mean, I don't think anyone should be surprised at what we're seeing here. But I think this is what happens, you know, and we've had presidents in the past who, you know, very much needed their ego to be stoked. But this is a president that has taken it to a whole new level. And this is what we're seeing.
Well, I say this only as a friend, Kathy, but you have 8 days to start naming stuff after yourself. I mean, the Sheehan Palace Theater.
No. Yes.
Kathy's Capital Rep. I mean, get going.
As I have said, I will come back and haunt anyone who tries to name anything after me. But this is what it looks like. And it's really dangerous, especially with somebody who has the billions of access to the billions of dollars of capital that this president has.
I think also, and I assume most people would agree, this program has such a sterling reputation. And yes, there have been times where it has gone to court.
But it's gold standard.
It's gold standard. Yeah. And even in the times, whether it be Westmoreland or the Dan Rather affair, I mean, these are things that were worked out, were questioned, were brought to attention, were worked out in court, and consequences were taken. I think very few news outlets don't have something in the that. It shows how good they are to be able to have things that are questioned and perhaps are run a fine line as to what is or is not appropriate. With that said, do things like this, which seems to be part of the motive here, at least to me, seems to be part of the motive here, is to also cut down on the credibility of a program that would then cut down on the audience of a program, which would then cut down on the need to have it be their premier program.
Well, I think you were onto something when you talked about the way Trump reacted to the Marjorie Taylor Greene interview and the fact that Trump had sued successfully and won a $15 million settlement against CBS after 60 Minutes edited, quote unquote, an interview with Kamala Harris from last year before the election. And knowing how litigious he is, and if you know someone is litigious, you're going to be extra careful to remove those those opportunities for them to pounce on you. So if I'm not saying I agree with Barry Weiss, but she is in a position where she has to balance the credibility of the program that had been, and I'll say had been, the gold standard for broadcast journalism, and risking giving the administration another hammer to use to pound on its credibility. We'll find out if this segment airs, and why the heck can't it air this coming Sunday? Of course, the Sunday between Christmas and New Year's. Who's watching 60
yeah,
Minutes?
Yeah, that's
the
prime time. 4 o'clock right
on
there.
A Friday afternoon.
Yeah. You know, and maybe for that, perhaps the cynic would say that achieved the goal. but whatever. I mean, it's still playing out, is what I'm saying, and there may be. Like I said, if this story does air, it may get a lot more eyeballs.
So before we take a break, but even if so, they go back and they include Stephen Miller. They do an interview with Stephen Miller. To the audience, is that going to fundamentally change anything?
It's not going to change the story. I mean, as you pointed out, it's out there streaming now. There's no putting that toothpaste back in the tube if there's anything that the president doesn't like in it. So,
but I guess even by adding Stephen Miller's voice, I mean, I don't think that most people are going to be changed by what he says, given what we know he's probably going to say.
I doubt it.
And what if he declines to be interviewed? Does that mean it doesn't run? I mean, is it true that that becomes a kill switch? I hope not. God, that would be awful.
Well, yeah, we'll see. And I do feel sorry for the people working at 60 Minutes,
absolutely,
who are trying to do their jobs and get things. 3 hours notice is, especially in television news.
Well, I watched 60 Minutes, and what I thought was interesting, it was very jarring because they did a segment and then they came back and it was more of the same segment, which they normally never do.
Never do.
And so I thought, well, this is odd. I thought there was supposed to be something on about this prison. And so the fact that they were able, and I think that's because they do for their online, they have longer versions of all of these stories. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to roll with it. But that had, I mean, talk about professionalism. It was only odd to me, not because of the content. The content was great, but that I was getting such a deep dive into the story that had to be stretched because they pulled this piece.
And we will go to a break, but I was, once you know these things, you tend to be more cynical.
Skeptical, too.
Skeptical, cynical. But when you when they did a story just a couple of weeks after the kerfuffle of Dana White, the UFC, the head of the UFC, and that was a very normal, I would say, what's the word I want to use? I think it wasn't a hit job. And it made the point over and over again about how much this guy has done for the country and how much he's working with the administration and how great President Trump is in doing this. And I just looked at that story much differently than I would have otherwise, because it did seem out of place. It just seemed odd. So there is that, too, in this discussion. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those when we return. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. I'll sing along. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jay Jochnowitz, Mike Spain, and Kathy Sheehan with us this morning. The mayor of Albany, at least for a couple more days. We have a lot of letters on 60 Minutes, and we'll get to those. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We start with Susan. Why is the lead not Trump administration and Stephen Miller refuse or are unable to defend this horrific policy?
I was thinking that the whole time we were talking, that and as you pointed out, Mayor, that the story that needs to be told is about all the abuses of this administration and all the things the administration's doing wrong. And unfortunately, here we are. I was thinking through the whole conversation, talking about CBS. And it's important that journalism has these discussions and that there's a reflection at CBS or a purge at CBS, whatever the case may be or needs to be. But we need to – Susan, it is absolutely right that is the story, that they can't defend this.
Amy says, to Jay's point, I don't believe the reporters who uncovered Watergate went to President Nixon for comment in advance either. it didn't make anything, and they reported false.
That's actually not true. I mean, they constantly sought yeah. White House, and the White House stonewalled them, and what was it, Ron? I can't think of his last name now, the spokesman for the White House during the Nixon administration. I mean, they poo-pooed, they called it lies, they called it everything, and later on said after all of it came out and the tapes were out and everything, those comments previously are no longer operative. I mean, at least they had the
Ron Ziegler.
Ron Ziegler. That's it. Sorry. Yeah. And I mean, no, they always try. And if that wasn't in the story, and it had to be in this story, that they have declined to comment and and make that part of the story. That's all. That's not the lead. The lead is I agree with you guys. The lead is the horrific things, the denial of due process, the just unjustified hauling of people off the streets and sending them to where they know they will be mistreated in El Salvador.
Well, and I have to say, I can only think in the last 12 years of one story that the Times Union ran that stated things, and they never called me or my office to verify whether or not it was true or to get my comment. And that was what made me furious. And first of all, they were demonstrably false statements. So, I was able to say, here's my calendar. This meeting never happened. This never occurred. And it was stunning to me that that story ran without any attempt to reach out to my office or to me to say, hey, we're going to say this happened, what's your comment? I mean, it's very common. I mean, that's what you expect. That's what journalism is.
But you know from your experience, that's not their common, right? I mean,
that was the exception.
Right.
Yeah, that's what exception. I say. It was one time in 12 years. And so, when that has happened, it was that jarring. And so, to that reader, I would question any journalist who wasn't making those calls to Stephen Miller and to the administration to say, hey, we're going to say this, right? Do you have a comment? That would be the typical practice. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to the letter from Maureen. I viewed the 60-minute segment on Canadian TV last night. It was an interview with a young Venezuelan victim. He described cruelty and torture, and I came away sick at heart. What illegal cruelty and lack of due process are we allowing in 2025? Not in my name. I'm more energized to resist than ever, which is probably why
they didn't want that.
They didn't want this story going on.
Do you actually think somebody from the White House called,
Barry
Ellison?
Weiss.
And Ellison called Barry Weiss, Ellison being the head of Paramount, Skydance, all that stuff.
I worry more that Barry Weiss called someone to say, hey, we're running this, and what do you think? I know that sounds, as paranoid as the whole deep state craziness, but it just seems as though this was an attempt to prevent this from airing by that happened at her level, at that level,
something happened. You have it viewed five times. It goes through all of the practices. Mm-hmm. It goes through all of the new rules that have been put in place.
Well, yeah, I mean, arguably she's brand new, so maybe the new rules aren't all set yet.
Right, but that would have been flagged earlier, and we assume that I assume, and I don't know this for fact. As a fact, whether she had viewed it prior. But
they claim that she did not, that she didn't watch any of the five different airings of it internally. And I believe that's probably the case. Maybe she finally looked at it at the very last minute and said, this can't go. But, I mean, I'm suspecting, and I don't know either, that they didn't pick up the phone. The White House didn't pick up the phone and said, there's a hit piece going on this and you got to stop it. It was probably more under the shadow of Paramount has this big deal going on to take over HBO and Time Warner. And the president just this last week said, I'm going to be involved in that process a great deal. And just knowing all that, Barry Weiss may have done what her boss wanted more than what journalistically should have been done.
Oh, I, I, I have no inside knowledge. I can only disagree with you on instinct, but this is a president who has no compunction about picking up the phone, talking to an official in Georgia and saying, I want you to change the vote.
Really?
In so many words. This is a president who has no compunction about having his FCC commissioner go out there and say, we're either going to do this the hard way, the easy way, or the hard way.
Jimmy Kimmel?
I don't have any doubt that in this administration that these are people who are willing to pick up the phone and say, you've got a deal going on. You want that deal to go through. You get this peace killed.
You could make a very good case.
The president wants to have a nice Christmas and hold it off to next Sunday, even if you have to. I don't know, but I don't think these people have any filter.
I know this isn't the thing I should be focused on, but what's a Trump nice Christmas?
I wondered the same thing, Jay.
Because you know you're going to get one of those Merry Christmas to all you loser liberal
idiots. We can finally say Merry Christmas.
It's one where Santa is flying through the sky in the Trump sleigh.
The Trump sleigh.
Series 1,000 and delivering gold-plated gifts to
and
all
only
his
the
friends.
And only his friends. And only the liberal elves were the ones who were bombed at a submission in the sky on the second strike.
Did I say I was not going to have a crossword?
Yeah, well, I told you that was going to go right out the window. Larry says Barry Weiss's justification for pulling the episode is disingenuous at best. Her claim that the story needed Stephen Miller's input fails the sniff test because Stephen Miller, Pete Hegseth, Kristi Noem, and many others were approached for such input. Standard practice in producing such reporting, they did not respond in any way. This is all made moot by the fact that the segment did air on a Canadian affiliate. I bet that's the thing that also is going to be addressed, that never happens again.
Yeah. And that was an accident. They just gave the Canadian affiliate a copy of it early with the intent of running it, and they never got the news that it wasn't supposed to run.
Right, yeah, because of the tariffs and such.
all related, I'm sure.
John says, if CBS ever airs this story, expect Donald Trump to sue CBS for defamation, seeking punitive damages. In addition, the FCC chairman will also try to revoke the license of CBS and every station that broadcasts the story. Then we check in with Paul, who writes, the country of the First Amendment with freedom of the press is now practicing censorship without resistance by some major media organizations. At least we still have some media like NPR who are not obeying. And I do think I understand the point of the letter and I appreciate it. I do think that the reporters at CBS, as well as those who were directly impacted, have been very outspoken on this issue, and I think they're obviously trying very hard to.
It's courageous. So it may end some of their careers with CBS,
right?
And hopefully not in their careers. But to speak out against your editorial leadership publicly is risky because it compromises their credibility and your ability to work with them, and it can be a very difficult situation.
Scott Pelley, Leslie Stahl, these are all people who have spoken out very strongly.
Scott Pelley had much to say.
Which is important. Marlene says, my opinion, the Trump administration is finally aware of how much many of the American people don't like loss of due process and the heavy-handed and cruel way that they/ICE are treating immigrants. And as I mentioned earlier in the article, in our discussion, there was another complaint that was leveled by Barry Weiss, was the use of the word migrant. And let me see, I think we may have one more letter here to bring us up to the top of the hour, and then we come back. We welcome yours, by the way, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So do we think that I'm interested in, you just think about this week, next week, back in January when things start to turn is what impact is even this discussion, this action having on the future reporting at 60 Minutes?
I think it's still to be determined what happens. I think that this has really reached a head with Barry Weiss, and that there's going to be a reckoning one way or the other. Either we're going to see some journalists losing their jobs, or we're going to see a change of leadership that's going to be as graceful as it possibly can be. And I can imagine the phrase, when a journalist becomes the story, it's time to step aside. And I have a feeling that's how she gets her exit is, you know, it's all unfair, but, you know, for the better of journalism, I'm going to leave, and I wasn't fired, I assure you.
Then you worry about who's brought in, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's always the case.
I mean, it is a story that is moving quickly and playing out, and it will, I think, define her future. How she handles this from this point forward, having looked back at the last week and had a lot of legitimate criticisms, how she handles it from this day forward will define whether she does end up succeeding or not at CBS, and it'll be fairly quickly.
Or it depends how CBS succeeds.
Yeah.
Well, right.
In terms of its credibility.
Well, and also, I mean, you look at this deal, and we have more news on it this morning that they've sweetened the deal for the takeover of Netflix and Time Warner. What effect that would have on CNN. The reason the president is involved is because he wants to have CNN a part of this so he can have his thumbprint on CNN. And yet another news organization that will, if this happens, would no doubt be greatly influenced by that decision.
Yeah, I think that I have a different take on this. I think this is, again, the new normal, and that what she did is something that her higher-ups are applauding. Mm-hmm. And so I think she stays, and I think that we see a fundamental shift in how we receive news, what we're told, and what we aren't told, and that's the goal, ultimately. And so looking at the potential takeover of CNN and any sense that there, you know, while there are those who say on the right who say that it's left biased, removing that left bias from the picture, these are the goals that they have. And so I think we are potentially seeing the beginning of the death or the continuation of the death of journalism, and a free press. And I think that we are going to start to see this happen, and we've seen it, and they've made it clear, and it's part of their plan. And so I don't think she gets fired. I think this is the new 60 Minutes.
We have two letters I want to read before
ho,
we go.
Ho, ho, ho.
Well, exactly. And on that note, Anthony writes to us and says, the fact that this piece on 60 Minutes was deleted is almost a positive. Not only was the piece horrible to hear and learn, now it's showing how the Trump administration has its hand on the scale of free speech. By the way, everyone, happy holidays, says Anthony. Finally, Mary says, well, I would boycott CBS in general, but especially tonight when it airs the Kennedy Center Honors.
What's that called again?
The Donald J. Trump and the John F. Kennedy
Memorial Art Kennedy. Center for the Art, yes. Performing Arts. Yes.
We will take a break. We will be back after a few words and news with Ray Graff. To be with the one you love. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings on this Tuesday, the 23rd of December, and playing Sharon Jones, It's a Holiday Soul Party is the album. The playlist is posted online, wamc.org/roundtable, and just a joy to listen to that on this Tuesday morning. Also a joy to hear our guest talk about the issues of the day. Jay Jochnowitz is here, Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Mike Spain with us as well. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we have other things to talk about. The mayor brought this up earlier, and so let's talk about it. The president announced a high-powered battleship that he said he would help design. President Trump on Monday said he will oversee the development of a new class of Navy battleship named after himself. The move was cast in part as an effort to give the nation's stagnant shipbuilding industry a shot in the arm, but also will upend the Navy's ship-naming norms and thrust presidential politics firmly into the program from its genesis. The announcement follows a flurry of recent actions by Trump to rebrand existing institutions to include his name, including the U.S. Institute of Peace and the JFK Center for the Performing Arts. Trump, speaking alongside Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and Navy Secretary John Phelan at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, said the new warships will have guns and missiles at the highest level, along with hypersonic weapons, electric rail guns, and lasers. You know, all the cool stuff. The first battleship to be called the USS Defiant will be part of a broader effort to build a modern, quote, golden fleet of warships, Trump said, indicating that he will play a leading role in the program. The U.S. Navy will lead the design of these ships along with me, because I'm a really aesthetic person, Trump said. The Navy said in a news release after the Trump announcement that the vessel, quote, will be the most lethal service combatant ever constructed and triple the size of a current Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, which is about 505 feet long and weighs about 9,000 tons. That would be smaller than existing aircraft carriers and amphibious assault ships, vessels that commonly carry Marines at sea. A logo unveiled for the new ship class depicts Trump in the moments after a July 2024 assassination attempt with his fist held high. The Trump class naming, first reported by the Wall Street Journal, would defy the Navy's longstanding, if unevenly applied, traditions of naming aircraft carriers after presidents and battleships after states. Almost all of the service's current carriers are named after former commanders-in-chief, including the USS Gerald R. Ford, the lead ship in a class of aircraft carrier that is expected to include other ships named after President Kennedy, President Clinton, and President George W. Bush. Typically, a class of warships share its name with the first vessel in that class. The Navy relied heavily on battleships during World War II, but they were eventually deemed obsolete and decommissioned. The last one to see active service was the Missouri, which was decommissioned in 92 and turned into a museum in Hawaii's Pearl Harbor. Phelan said the battleship would become part of the nation's nuclear arsenal, carrying nuclear cruise missiles. The weapon was approved by Trump during the first term, canceled by the Biden administration, and then revived by Congress in 2024. But whether the nuclear missile is actually built and included on the ship is beside the point, said Mark Kansian, a senior advisor in the Defense and Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies think tank. He questioned whether the vessel itself ever would be built, noting that its significant size will saddle the battleship with similar limitations and vulnerabilities as the nation's other warship. But see, the thing is, you need somebody with an aesthetic take care of those problems.
Trump said that he has a visual of a battleship that's really cool looking.
Yeah.
Well, and I think
and that's all I look for. By the way, that reporting for the Washington Post. Yes, Kathy.
But and I think that that's where we're not getting this from the Pentagon, right?
Well, and Hegseth was right next to him.
He was. But again, this is a president who's just whatever thought pops into his head. He is surrounded by minions who say that's a great idea. And let's do this. And let's mock this up, even though I have no idea. It sounds like from some of the people who've chimed in who have a lot of experience here that this might not be where we want to invest billions of dollars to protect Americans and to ensure that we have the defense that we need as we look at what's happening in China and with Russia. And so I don't forget
Venezuela.
And Venezuela. but again,
that was sarcasm.
This is a big ego sitting in a room saying, today, let's have battleships. And tomorrow, I don't know what it'll be.
Glass spaceships.
Maybe.
That's a reference to one of the first dystopian novels out there, We, written by a Russian dissident author. And they were building throughout that book, in the kind of the background of the story, was the building of a spaceship made entirely out of glass. This whole society was essentially being made out of glass. So it was a not too subtle metaphor for the end of privacy and the end of individuality in society. And, I was reminded of that, and I was also reminded of the brilliant military wherewithal of one of the great leaders of the 20th century and great victors of Adolf Hitler, who fancied himself a military genius, and we all know what happened to Nazi Germany. I am not comparing Trump to Hitler in any other way except to say the hubris of this man is breathtaking. The fact that he's building a warship that, as you pointed out, is just going to be a drain on very real things. It doesn't matter if this ever sees the light of day. It's going to, it's going to drain resources. It's going to drain intelligence. It's not intelligence that I'm talking about, but the capital of talent that has to go into this. All the things that are going to be sacrificed to this, and then it's going to probably live on past him, because once these things get started, it's very hard for the military to say, all right, well, we're just canceling all the contracts now.
It reminds me, and I know this may be a tortured analogy, but it just reminds me of the couple who sits in the furniture store and decides what kind of couch they want, and they wanted this, and they wanted a sectional, and they want to do this, and they build this, and it's going to take 12 weeks to do, and it ultimately takes 24 weeks, and they build it, and they fabric swatches and all this stuff, and then they try to deliver it to your house, and they can't get it through the door.
Right.
You know, it just seems like that. And at one point, there's a contractor outside who's like, well, if we take one of the windows out, we could probably get it in. I don't know. I just, aesthetic, but is it practical? And is it, and
it's not what the people who are schooled in the military,
that's right,
are saying. We need smaller, nimble ships. We need to be able to respond quickly. You know, turning a ship like that around would take a couple days.
And I also think that, here is this is why it's dangerous. Exactly to your point, there is intellectual capacity that is going to be placed on this project that we really need to be looking at the threat of AI and what do we need in order to defend our shores and to ensure that we continue when Trump talks about this whole America first and all of that, putting America first does mean understanding and having boots on the ground in other places so that we know what's coming and that we can prepare for that. And so you have Senator Gillibrand, who has created a program that provides for tuition reimbursement for those who put themselves through school in order to do cybersecurity, because it's such an essential field. And she has talked about having a vision of having the equivalent of a West Point for IT and for cybersecurity, because this is a huge threat. Those are the things that I think Americans need to know and ensure that those who are really looking at this and understand strategically what the threats are, that we're prepared for it so that we're not caught flat-footed. We spent billions of dollars on a ship that then has all of its systems jammed because we haven't been doing cybersecurity. Right. And the thing has been completely corrupted. I mean, so that is the danger. This isn't just Trump and his ego. I believe that we are less safe today because of these types of decisions.
And as we indicated, as they move forward, and how do you turn it around? Because they continue to to be worked on. And I think people say, well, we'll just try to stall it out. But that's
a strategy. I mean, of every administration, knowing that they're not going to be there forever, they want to get something deeply planted so it can't be turned around. You could say that about Obamacare. You could say that about certain tax cuts that were done in the first Trump administration. You want to get these things in so it makes it very difficult to undo them. And that's why I think he's moving ahead with it now, just like, you know, that stupid East Wing on the White House, you know. It's they're trying to get all this stuff going so it gets far enough along that they can't undo it when Trump leaves office at the end of 2028.
You know, it's weird that he hits 2 points in this that I have to give him credit for. One is the aesthetics of the last big ship that got unveiled, that kind of tin can looking thing that is apparently a really incredible warship in itself, or I'm not sure what class it is, but boy, is it one ugly ship. He hits that stupidity in us that says, well, I don't like the looks of that ship, It can't be very good.
This vision of a giant Tesla pickup truck in the ocean.
It does look like that. And the other thing was naming it the Defiant was just, that's where it almost broke me down in the story. That was the name of the ship in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And the Defiant, as Captain Sisko pointed out, was overbuilt. It's very interesting that he chose the Defiant because it was a ship that was so big and so powerful that they were worried that just firing the weapons on it would damage the ship.
I'm so glad you told me that. That is amazing. That's awesome.
It's a beautiful metaphor.
It really is. That's amazing.
This is why I watch Star Trek all these years. This was research. This wasn't entertainment.
Sharing
journalistic
with us.
Research.
Dear wonderful roundtable panelists, writes Terry, when I read about the battleship being called Trump class, first off, that's an oxymoron. And then we could have a drinking game for every time he names something after himself. If this wasn't so scary and sad, we could really have fun. Bless you all, and let's say strong, says Terry. I did want to read on that point Thomas Oppel, who served as chief of staff to the Navy Secretary during the Obama administration, said Trump's apparent desire to have a class of warship named after him would be hilarious if it wasn't so sad. That was his quote when reached by the media for a comment. Then we go to this letter from Shyla, who says, feels like Trump is just cycling through board games at this point. Battleship, Monopoly, Trivial Pursuit. I hope he stays away.
Candyland, right?
He says, I hope he stays away from the game Trouble.
Oh, right.
Yes. Okay. Good point. I'd also be worried about Operation.
I was going to say, he's already got RFK Jr. on Operation. So.
Let's see. Roger says, perhaps this boat will probably capsize upon launching due to all of the gold he would put on it. Then we have this from Rick. These are not battleships. They look more like frigates or destroyers, that according to Rick. Peggy writes to us and says, remember when New Yorkers had the Trump name taken off their buildings? It can't come soon enough that this garish gold gift and his name are torn off all of the new attempts at a legacy. How disgraceful, how embarrassing. I'm a faithful listener and a WAMC member. And Peggy, we wish you a beautiful holiday. Thank you.
It's a tough thing because now if a new administration, let's say the Democrats do win in 2028, like it is predicted they will at this point, but it's very early. I mean, if they just come in and undo everything Trump did and stop the West Wing or the East Wing from being rebuilt and do something else and, you know, take his name off this, Kennedy Center, get rid of the coins that have his image on them and stuff like that, it's just going to look petty and it's going to distract from moving forward. And yet, I think a lot of people might want that to happen. Are we going to purge him, you know, the way that China purged Mao after he left? You know, I mean, it's just setting up years and years of more bitter fighting and at a time when we just can't afford to do that. Yeah, it's tough.
But I do think that that's what people are going
to
want to
be
see.
Demanding. And, oh, yeah.
And I think part of it is the way that he has gone about doing some of these things. It's not because Congress said, we think that we should rename this building after you. He's really taken these institutions that many of them exist because of Congress, and because he controls Congress, they've sat idly by and allowed him to do it, which is, to me, as anti-American as you can get. So I understand. I don't think that we're going to have the luxury of being able to be super petty, because I do worry about the safety aspects of these decisions that are being made, what's going to be happening to our economy over the next 3 years. I worry about a deep recession, if not worse. I worry about a lot of things. So I think we're going to have a lot of work to do cleaning up stuff.
What about the medical, FDA and CDC? What are they going to do about vaccination recommendations again?
Right.
What about, you know, what's going to happen to Tylenol?
With all due respect, Mayor, I do want to say I hope you will allow me to be petty. But when the listener wrote the letter about the boycotting the Kennedy Center honors tonight, so... And I'm just talking out loud because I have because I have a microphone.
And it's your program,
right? It's helpful, I must say. But just the thing that like just bored into my brain is, so is there a conversation right now happening with CBS as to during the references of this event that it's referred to as the Trump?
It's a very interesting question.
The Trump Kennedy Center, or because this event took place before that it wouldn't, but now that it would. And do you think, because my bet would be yes, that a call took place to say, please make sure that is included within the context of this event?
That would speak volumes about CBS. I mean, you know, AP, you know, defiantly.
They're still fighting it.
Refuses the Gulf of America thing, and to their credit, it hasn't been renamed officially, in their view, and a lot of the world to which they report outside the United States does, you know, isn't under Trump's thumb that it has to accept that.
I just think it'll be an interesting thing to watch tonight.
Yeah,
it may also be painful, Joe.
Yeah.
Why would you put yourself through that?
Well,
I mean, first of all,
I'm going to be with the listener who boycotts it, but I want to read about it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I look at the septuagenarians and octogenarians that are being honored, and I don't know. You know, I'm one of those people that I like to look at snippets of the program afterwards. But I think that matching petty with petty, sometimes you lose the high ground. And I don't think we should cede the high ground. I mean,
no,
right?
I agree.
Him naming it after himself is about as petty as it gets.
Absolutely. I wonder how the network will handle it. I wonder how that will go down. And it takes away, once again, and this is what this president seems to be so good at, takes away from the people who are being honored. And we can certainly question as to how, you know, the list. But they all have long track records of entertaining this country in one way, shape, or form. But you take away that as well because of the brouhaha over the naming and so forth.
So I think some of this, to get to the issue of what we do with some of this stuff, I think is an important question. It should be a petty question. You know, this all is all petty stuff, but it kind of adds up.
It does.
And
yeah.
You know, I've had this one image in my head of that Lenin statue lying on its side after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I look forward to that day in America when we get to watch that name being pulled off. But I have a feeling some of this is going to resolve itself after 26, because I think we're going to get a Democratic Congress, and at least in the House, and I think the House, leadership is going to start pushing back on some of the things that have usurped Congress's power. And it will include big stuff, but it will also include little stuff. Like they'll say, the Kennedy Center is ours to name or not name. Get that. Get your name off it right now.
I mean,
and in fact, we're gonna send some Capitol janitors over to take it off. I don't know. But I think some of that those fights are going to be fought over the next few years because that riles their base. And hopefully we won't have presidential candidates having to argue about this in 28 to the extent that we might otherwise.
I mean, when I saw when you see the wrecking crew on the East Wing, I mean, that's really when it struck me of like, okay, so this is, I mean, this just isn't like, I'm going to name this after me or I'm going to do, I mean, that's like, when you start tearing stuff down, that's a pretty decisive action.
It's all mine.
Well,
it's all mine to do with
what I want.
The
big thing is to get something in the ground as soon as he can so that it can't be undone right. When he leaves office, and I think that's his goal.
And I think that the broader question, and, you know, probably not for today, but is to look back at history when we've appeased people like Donald Trump. And so there are those who have taken the appeasement route. And certainly leaders in Europe have taken that route of just saying, okay, this is a person with a ego that you cannot possibly stoke too much. And so as long as you stoke that ego, you can get what you want and he won't be paying attention to you. And so we're going to do that, right? And so I think that that is what part of what we're seeing. And yet I think for us, there's that reaction, that gut reaction of, no, if you appease this, what next?
Yeah.
And I think that's where we're at.
I think we're finding out what next. And this is...
We're going to take a quick break.
Sorry.
That's all right. I'm sorry. Before you get going, I just want to... Yeah.
I was just going to say, we're 11 months into this, not 12 yet. And there's three more years to go.
We have a half hour left in this program, so we can create all kinds of trouble. We'll do that right after this break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Let's see. We have some letters I want to get to, then we'll move on to another topic. We go to Jeff. You know who else has a vaunted Navy? Russia. You know what Russian Navy is doing to Ukraine? Nothing. Because Ukraine learned to jerry-rig jet skis and turn them into waterborne drones for a few thousand dollars. They have entirely disabled the Russian Navy with ingenuity, not huge scale. Ukraine's ingenuity is a future of naval warfare, not bloated scale. That letter from Jeff. Ryan says, I think the reason battleships are retired is because obsolete.
That's the word, obsolete.
Yeah, so the reason battleships are retired and become obsolete is because today's tech can turn them out using long range or even from space-based weapons. It's susceptible to atomic weapons, as seen in tests at the Bikini Islands. Even if it survives, it would be radioactive. That from Ryan. We go to Eric. I think it's a common theme from this morning that has already been discussed, normalizing the behavior that is totally not normal. This is only allowed to happen because people follow the bidding of the president. I hate to overuse the Holocaust as an example, but Hitler did not kill anyone, but a lot of people were willing to follow. Today, we will see ICE, the FBI, the military, news organizations, big business, tech, etc. For people who know their history, this is a scary moment.
What's the line there? It's, I was just following orders. Yeah.
That's right. Robert.
And now we're going to arrest for treason?
Oh.
Folks who reminded our military that you don't just follow orders, you have to follow lawful orders. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be brought up on sedition charges.
Robert writes, everything that Trump did illegally should be reversed. That is not petty. It is legally correct. Then Chris reminds us not to boycott the arts. I don't believe any of us mentioned that, but I agree with you.
I think it's a reference to the Kennedy Center.
Yes, we don't want to boycott the... Oh, well, we don't want to boycott... Well...
I think there's plenty of other arts besides the Kennedy Center, and as long as
I think
the Kennedy
not watching
Center,
Gene Simmons get inducted into the Kennedy Center is, I think you're okay.
Yeah,
seems all right. Go. There's a lot of great artistic work available.
There's a great show at Cap Rep. There is a lot
going
on.
Yeah, there's a lot of wonderful arts happening.
Proctor's has a huge lineup. So
The Times Union has a good story today. Just looking back at the year, one of its big stories was how many local arts organizations are suffering because the federal grants that work their way down have been cut so much. And it is a time to support the arts.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's see. We go to. I heard Trump's primetime speech referred to as the Pettysburg Address. I don't have a problem with Democrats exhibiting fight with some pettiness. That from John. Patrick is predicting that Trump will start adding his face to Mount Rushmore by the end of 2026, and his face will be bigger than the other four. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but ... ha ha ha. We go to this from Ryan. I think the reason battleships are retired is... Oh, I read that. My apologies. All letters are better when they're read twice. Is taking down the Trump legacy different than taking down Civil War rebel statues? And what about the new plaques under President's paintings in the White House? That according to Gary.
To that point, I think that... a well-framed argument about why that's necessary and how offensive all this has been to American values, I think well-constructed could make this not petty. Mm. I think it's in the hands of a skilled orator. I think the argument could be made, but, obviously you don't make this the centerpiece of your presidential campaign.
And we have to find a skilled orator, but go ahead.
And I thought that those plaques, I thought that the plaques and what he... tweeted about Rob Reiner were fake news. I thought this cannot possibly be true.
Right.
And I think that's where, for those who are staunch defenders of this president and this type of action on his part, how can it be petty to undo it?
Yeah.
I mean, if what he has done is not petty and just so not worthy of the office that he holds...
Yeah.
Then, I don't see how they can be up in arms about it. If they think that this is okay, then it's got to be okay to undo it.
Mm-hmm. Doug writes to us and says, we can't have a drinking game in which we take a swig every time Trump names something after himself. A, we'd get drunk way too quickly. B, Jim Beam is shutting down.
No.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. For a year, so they can retool the distillery, and they don't need to have extra stock because of the decline in the sales. Of liquor.
By the way, your concern on that, Jay, was great. What?
I am a bourbon drinker. I like high end bourbon.
Yeah.
Somebody treated me to one this year that was something I had never heard of. It was called Confiscated by Kentucky Owl.
Yep.
It was a favor. I had done them a favor redoing their deck for them. And, they bought me a bottle of that, and I sipped it over months. But Jim Beam is my backup. Is like my, when I want to make just a cheap Manhattan, it is perfectly good bourbon.
Well,
and
go
this
stock
is part
up.
Of a big part of tourism in Kentucky.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. And then we have this letter from Joe that says the Carnival Cruise Line poop ship was the Triumph. So easy to drop a couple of letters to name the ship after him. Okay. We retire this subject for the time being and we move on to other things. And we would like to talk about the ambassadors who are being recalled. The Trump administration abruptly recalls over 24 career ambassadors. I would have loved to have had Fred Hoff, Ambassador Fred Hoff, on our program today. The Trump administration has recalled more than 24 career diplomats from ambassador positions and other senior posts around the world as it works to enforce adherence with President Trump's America First agenda, current and former U.S. officials said. The directive has infuriated State Department personnel who say it will leave key embassies without critical leadership and may effectively end the careers of many ambassadors who will have only 90 days to find new jobs within the department, a tall order during a moment of limited high-level positions. The Washington Post story goes on to say, to remove these senior diplomats without cause or justification sends a dangerous message, the American Foreign Service Association, the union that represents U.S. diplomats, said in a statement. It tells our public servants that loyalty to country is no longer enough, that experience and oath to the Constitution take a back seat to political loyalty. A senior State Department official said, quote, this is a standard process in any administration.
This story goes on to point out that there's kind of two levels of ambassadors. So there's the high-profile political appointments that are usually big fundraisers, and it's a reward. And there are people who are like former administration officials of that party, and they leave on day one, and that's standard. They know they're up. You know, they know Newt Gingrich knew he was done at the Vatican as soon as Joe Biden was elected president. I mean, that's the way it is. And then there's another level of professional ambassadors who understand the intricacies of diplomacy and geopolitics, and they are professionals, and they often have to modify their positions for each administration comes in. They do it well, and they protect the interests of the U.S. validly on foreign soil. And those are the guys that are being pushed out now. And this is like a brain drain already. I thought Rubio was like the adult in the room, the one guy who kind of knew, and he was in the right. Senate Intelligence Committee, kind of knew what was going on. And why he cut just the numbers in the State Department during the whole Doge thing is backfiring, and now he's getting rid of the talent that was built up over the years, and it's going to take years to bring all that back. I mean, these people are leaving. It's the end of their careers. It isn't like it can just flip a switch if a new president comes in and hire them all back. That doesn't happen. James Mattis, who was the first defense secretary under the first Trump administration, used to say, for every dollar we spend on diplomacy, I save $10 on the defense budget. You know, it is the most worthwhile spending we can possibly do, and we're just gutting it.
Mayor?
I think that one of the things that I'm seeing as a mayor is a huge focus on really making sure that local elected officials, like mayors, like town supervisors, county executives, that we understand the importance of subnational diplomacy. And there was a big push on this actually under the Biden administration, and it has continued with a number of the NGOs that work in this space, because they're truly alarmed at the potential impacts, whether you are a whiskey maker in Kentucky or you're growing soybeans in Iowa or wherever they grow soybeans.
One
of those places, sorry. reason the rest of the country hates New Yorkers, but understanding that what happens with diplomacy overseas impacts at that hyper local level is really important, and so this is something that I think should be very concerning to all Americans. I understand that the president gets to decide, but I also understand that there are some places where we need professionals who do this and understand the language, the culture, have the relationships. Oftentimes those relationships are built at the staff level, and that it's important because you can talk about these unelected bureaucrats, but in a way our country has worked because of unelected bureaucrats in the past. And as somebody who came in as a new mayor, it's some of those unelected bureaucrats, right, that say, well, wait a minute, that's not how we're going to do things, and here are the real rules that apply. And
here's what works.
Right? Like, you're trying to go fast. We're trying to go the right way. And those are the folks that really understand and have those relationships. So whether it's an Ebola outbreak that happens in some remote area of some country on the African continent, or a new drug cartel that is building itself right in South America, it's these folks that are the ones that are that first line of defense. And so, yeah, it when I say I feel as though this administration is making our country more vulnerable and less safe, it's these types of decisions that I'm talking about.
I would agree with everything that's been said. The years ago, when newspapers were much larger and with bigger budgets, there was a robust national conference for editorial writers. And the best part of the year was not their annual convention. It was their annual State Department briefing. This administration after administration for decades, I think, had carved out time for editors from around, editorial page editors and opinion editors from around the country to come there and stay for a day of briefings. And when I went, the times that I went, and I think I went like four or five years, you spent a day with diplomats, people who were, you know, like in charge of whole regions, as well as people who were in charge of whole regions of the world. And our approach to diplomacy and those things. Those things were so invaluable that when I tried to clean my desk years later, and I saved every one of those years in a binder, and I would go to clean them out, and I'd open it up, and I'd go, oh, this is still an issue. This is still an issue. This is still going on. This is expertise that like a lot of people don't know about. I would sometimes refer to this stuff. And when you talk about safety, you know, there were people that came in. It wasn't just State Department people, but you saw how integrated the military was with this. We had military people come in. Ben Rhodes came in once from the White House. Yeah. And generals came in. I was profoundly taken with one general who came in to talk about global warming at a time when I think we were on the tail end of the Bush administration, or maybe it was during the Obama administration. But you know, he had such a sober view of how important, for all the politics of this and all the denialism that was still going on then and still going on now, of how serious a challenge this was for the military and where our resources needed to be in the world, what we needed to understand about the devastation that could occur in strategic parts of the world because of global warming. For an administration to wrap all this up in ideology and personal and partisanship and stuff is so dangerous to this country. It's not just short-sighted. It's dangerous.
We'll take a break. We'll continue and wrap up the show after this short moment pause. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a few minutes left before we call it a panel, and then we'll have another hour of our program, and we're going to take a day or two off, or 2 days off for the holidays, and be back on Friday morning. Well, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, you are at the end of your term. You will be leaving. Are you completely moved out of the office?
I'm getting close.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I'm going to work up until the last day. I'm still trying to get some legislation passed. So.
Oh, how's that going?
On my council. I don't know. We'll see. people got their money's worth out of me, though. I'm not.
Yeah, you're there to the bitter end.
I'm there to the bitter end, whether right. they like it or not.
You know, there are quite a few articles out there about your leaving and about you know, what you're doing next and the next chapter and all of that stuff, and also of what the last 12 years has been like of mayor of the city. You seem to be a public servant who, at the end of 12 years serving the city, that you are not as bitter as I think most people would be. And if you are, you don't appear to be.
Yeah, why would I be bitter? You know, it's...
Well, the job is hard, right? I mean, it's a hard
job.
But
no one forces you to do it. And I think for me, that's the thing about... And I remind the people who work for the city that we're public servants. Like, the only reason that I had a job is to serve the residents of the city of Albany. And not everyone's always going to like what you do. And sometimes you have tough decisions to make. And sometimes you go too fast and get it wrong. And people have opinions about that. But that's the job. I feel like that's what I signed up for.
At what point did you say, okay, I've had enough. I can run again. I'm not going to.
Well, I certainly, when I ran for my third term, did so with, you know, not hesitation, but it was not something that I had planned to do. I had really planned on serving two terms. And then COVID happened, and all of these projects that were in the pipeline and that were moving forward, and, you know, we had paid off the landfill, the budget that I would be leaving for the next mayor was going to have a lot more headroom in it. And then all of that imploded with the pandemic. And I really felt as though my experience and having been sitting in that chair was something that would be helpful as we sought to navigate our way through a lot of unknowns. And so I decided to run for a third term, knowing that there was no way I was going to do a fourth term, because for a few reasons. One, I have some other things I'd like to do.
Yep.
And two, I do believe that changes in leadership are really important, and that when you're in an office like the mayor's office, that there are things that you want to accomplish and that you want to do. And then there's an opportunity to say, let's get a fresh set of eyes on this and let's let the next generation. To me, it was generational as well. I mean, I'm the very tail end of the baby boomers, but I felt as though it was time for there to be new, fresh perspective, new ideas, new people coming to the table.
Which has always been the mantra in the Albany mayor's office.
Yes, I know. interesting,
put in a
right?
Very, very slight period of time, right. And then move on.
But,
yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I experienced it. You get comfortable with certain people. You have certain ideas. There are people who have been upset and are not going to engage with you because of a decision that you made on a certain policy issue. And so, again, I think that the city benefits from, and that any democracy benefits from, new, fresh leadership.
How has the transition with Dorsey Appleers been going?
You know, I think it's been very helpful to have the amount of time that we had, because the primary is so much earlier now.
Right.
When I was elected the first time, the primary was in September. So it was a much shorter ramp there. And she has a transition team, and I have sat down with her and talked about the projects that are still sitting on my desk that aren't complete. You know, I've left her a lot of material to say, hey, you know, look at the $200 million and the CAP initiative that the governor has and what's going on with Liberty Park and all of these things, so that she isn't coming at it with, you know, day one and not knowing what's going on. So I've left some things, and I think that it will be she's been in city government. You know, she
right.
was in citywide elected office, and she has, I think, you know, had the opportunity to really benefit from being much more a part of my administration. I was not, even though I was in elected office, I was not a part of the Jennings administration. I was not invited to his leadership meetings. I did not participate in the creation of the budget. We really pulled the mayor-elect in, and even before she was running for mayor, she was invited to my leadership meetings.
Right.
We, you know, included her in the budget.
Is this a mayoral thing where you leave a letter to her on the desk?
I've already drafted it.
Oh, look at that.
That's very cool.
That's very nice.
And Mayor Jennings left me a letter as well. I think it's a lovely tradition.
It is a lovely tradition, yeah. You'll take some time off, and you'll let the dust settle, and hopefully, you know, one day you're going to say, man, I'm not mayor anymore, and this kind of rocks.
Well, I think, yeah, not having my phone ring at 2 o'clock in the morning will be
nice.
Will be nice. And, you know, I've talked with other mayors, including a mayor who said, okay, well, here is my plan, is that for 3 months, don't do anything. And then for 3 months, you talk to people and get ideas about what you want to do. And then in the last 3 months, you make a decision about what you're going to do. Only he had already accepted 2 consulting gigs. And when he gave me this advice, and it had only been, I think, a couple months for him. And so I too have done the same thing, because there was some, I was approached and asked about doing this pilot gig that would be relatively part-time, 25 to 30 hours a week, and it just sounds too interesting for me to pass up. So I'm going to do that, and I'm going to continue to talk to people and think about what I want to do next.
We're thrilled that you'll continue doing our show. It was a great blessing for us to have a sitting mayor on the show and being a regular, so we really appreciate that, and we'll also appreciate what words of wisdom you have afterwards and in the coming months and years. I thank you very much for everything that you've done.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for being so nice to the radio station as well. Have a beautiful holiday. Have a beautiful journey. Thank you very much. We'll talk soon. Jay Jochnowitz, you're the best. Mike Spain, you as well. Have a beautiful holiday season.
Well, we can't both be the best. You're going to have to make a choice.
No, you're good. It's, you know what? According to the best of the Times Union, you two are the best. Holiday greetings to both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And be well. We'll be back right after this.